Phyllis White, Reel 2. So people really were leaving at this time for sort of practical reasons like education.
Yes. We had quite a pleasant voyage on the Vossevar to the East Indies and down to Brisbane and then Sydney, where we disembarked. Stayed a few days with some friends of my parents and then went by train, which was an overnight journey from Sydney to Melbourne, where we were met by some other acquaintances of my mother's from Singapore, who had come down earlier, staying in a very second-class hotel, very old-fashioned indeed. My sister took one look at it and said, I'd sooner go to school, I think. And I stayed, so she did, and I stayed in the hotel, which was quite something, very old-fashioned. And walked around Melbourne quite safely with a map and found my way around. It's all planned out on a grid system. All the roads run north, south, or east and west. So once you knew the names of the streets, it was easy to find your way about. There were lovely gardens and parks in Melbourne, and the university itself was in a special area up in North Melbourne, and the colleges, like most of the schools in Australia, were all denominational: Church of England, Presbyterian, Methodist and Catholic. And Trinity College was the Church of England college to which I was attached through the Ladies' College, Janet Clark Hall. She was the lady who had given the money to further young women's education. But she was quite determined that we wouldn't lose the ability to be domesticated besides being intellectual, and so we all had to do a fortnight's domestic science course before term started. I'd never done any cooking. I've always lived in boarding school or other people's houses, so I wasn't very good at it. I thought it was a terrible waste of time. But it was quite a pleasant college, rather a gloomy building, having been built in the Edwardian days, I suppose. But the girls were nice, as all the other students were nice. And I went to lectures in French and German, which were my chosen subjects, and so Latin, which was compulsory. And we had quite a good social life with the young men in Trinity College next door, and got to know people in the other colleges also.
Had the war impinged on Australian society at that time in 1941?
No, not really, except that, of course, Australian troops had been sent to North Africa and had been much engaged in the war there, and were caught up in Tobruk, which was a lot of Australians were taken prisoner in Tobruk, or they were casualties in the warfare.
Would that have been very much in the news?
Yes, and according to Australian papers, which were exceedingly provincial in their reporting, there were hardly any troops fighting in North Africa except Australians. But it was understandable, I think, that so many families had been caught up in the war and fighting so far from home, and not with an argument that really concerned a country so far away the other side of the world. But of course, when the Japanese came into the war, things took on a very different complexion, and they were very much afraid of a Japanese invasion in the Northern Territories, Darwin and Townsville. And Japanese submarines, miniature submarines, were spotted in Sydney Harbour and also in Port Phillip Bay, which is where Melbourne is situated. But they were only on reconnaissance, I think.
Had you heard at that stage from your parents, you know, when the Japanese started?
Yes, I have actually a lot of letters from my father, who has nobly kept writing to us. It so happened that the long vacation for the university and my sister's school, which was between 2 and 3 months long, from December to January and February, was about to start, and there was a problem as to where we should go and what we should do by ourselves. So my mother decided to come down to Australia to be with us, and took her about 3 days to fly down from Singapore. And to Sydney, and then from Sydney overland to Melbourne. She arrived about 2 days before December the 7th. And, of course, stayed for the next 3.5 years. Which actually was in a very fraught situation, a bonus for my sister and myself, because we had a nice little home of our own at a place called Frankston, 30 miles from Melbourne. And it was the first time since we were small children that we'd had lived for so long together as a family. Of course, our father was still locked up in Singapore, but it made a great deal of difference to my sister and myself.
Did you know about your father, what had happened? Did you get any messages?
We didn't for ages, and the Japanese were very slow and unkind in not letting news of prisoners and civilian internees through. They deliberately didn't bother, but they were also totally overwhelmed by the enormous number of men that had come into their possession. I really didn't know what to do with them.
Was that a shock in Australia, that Singapore had fallen?
Absolutely, given these, because 85,000 Australians had just gone up to Singapore, landed a few days before the surrender of the city, and they were locked up or sent up to the, eventually to the railway in Siam, and suffered terribly.
Did it lead to any anti-British feeling in Australia?
Yes, there was. We noticed that, because we went into shops or restaurants with our English accents, we were not served with much politeness for a while, but they got over it afterward. It was for young woman like me, I was then 19. Well, it was a very traumatic time, really. The bottom of one's life had fallen out. And we didn't know, also, how we stood financially. Because my mother's experience of the Colonial Office government in London, which was very often not very sympathetic to families, had there was a possibility of them being very difficult about money, but in actual fact they came up trumps and allowed us any allowances that our father had previously budgeted for, because he was sending money down, of course, for my university and my sister's school fees. And my mother had obviously made some arrangement so that she would have money available. So in actual fact, we weren't really very hard up. But it took some time for this to be sorted out. People who had come down as refugees from Hong Kong, and I think some from Singapore with no previous financial arrangements, actually only got a very basic sum, and some of them suffered quite severely financially and had to find jobs or make some arrangement for looking after themselves and their children. The military were looked after by the War Office. That was quite a different setup, because of course there were wives and children there from Singapore, and also there were a number of Indian Army officers' wives with children in Australia. In the area where we lived, there were about 40 families, which made a sort of congenial atmosphere, because we were all in the same boat and could look after each other and be friendly with each other. There were naturally people from the Far East living in Sydney, and also a good many in Perth as well. But we didn't have much to do with them, because interstate travel was too difficult. You weren't allowed to travel except for special reasons. The railways were not very good anyway in Australia in interstate services. They were dependent on coal, of course, for steam trains, and there were problems with coal supplies, both for civilians and the industry, because they didn't have deep mine coal in Australia. They have brown coal, which is all surface mined.
So when did you start receiving news of your father?
We didn't hear for a long, long time. And we never, I don't know why, but we never received any letters from him. Other people had letters, few and far between. But we had radio messages. why that was, I don't know. But we sent letters. One time we sent quite a lot of letters, and then instructions were given out through the Red Cross that you could just send a very short letter, 25 words. It had to be typed out or written in capital letters. And there were things that you could and couldn't say. But I don't think a lot of those letters never got through. My father did actually get some, because we actually sent some photographs of ourselves. And I was able to tell him by letter that I was engaged to this young man that he used to tease me about.
What sort of messages were you getting by radio? How would these have come to you? Would somebody have picked these up and
written
them out?
There must have been some sort of central place where they went to, whether it was through the Red Cross. I can't remember, and I haven't got any notes about it, but I know in letters that I sent to Linton that, you know, I'd say we'd had a message. They came through Saigon radio very often. And they were picked up by radio hands, as I think they were called. And also, in the building where I worked, the Australian Broadcasting Commission had a receiving station, I suppose you would call it, in the top of the building, and every now and again they sent lists down, because the Japanese sometimes they didn't send messages, but they would send lists of I don't know about army men, but certainly internees, and there was just a short message, they were safe and well, something like that. And in the office that I worked in, I gave up the university and worked for the Netherlands Indies Government Information Service.
Which government?
Netherlands Indies.
Netherlands Indies.
Yes.
And in the information office?
Information Service.
Did you give up because of the financial situation?
Partly, and also I couldn't see the relevance of European languages in the Far East with the situation as it was. I felt I must do something that had more connection with the war. I didn't want to join the forces because it would have meant leaving my mother alone, and she'd come down especially to look after us. And I didn't feel obliged to join Australian forces being an English woman. And this job was suggested to me by a friend who had contact with the Netherlands Indies people. And as I had already learnt a little Dutch in the university, and before the war we had been to Holland a couple of times, and we knew Dutch people in Singapore.
Of course, there were a lot of Dutch people in the Far East, weren't there?
Yes.
Because of their colonial situation. Yes. Was it dealing, the job you were doing, was it dealing with sort of internee matters?
No, it was really a publicity machine. The Dutch were very anxious that they shouldn't be written off, as it were. And they'd set up a trade commission, this information service, and there was a Dutch naval office there also. I tried for a job in that, but my Dutch wasn't good enough for. And there were a lot of Dutch troops there. And a good many civilians too, who managed to get out. We had a very cosmopolitan lot of people in the office. Dutch, English, Australian, Hungarian.
What were you doing? What was your job?
Well, we had every single newspaper that we could lay our hands on, all radio reports, any published matter concerning the Netherlands Indies, the Japanese in the Pacific, and the Southeast Asia co-prosperity sphere, as they like to call it, and any radio messages or radio broadcasts, absolutely anything that was of information concerning what might be happening in a territory that the Japanese had occupied, and also Japanese propaganda as compared to what actually happened in, you know, the warfare in the Pacific, in Solomon Islands, Guadalcanal, what the Americans were doing, because the Americans, after the Solomon Islands and Guadalcanal, they came in great numbers to Australia for rest and recuperation. And rather swamped the Australian female market for a while.
Yes, was it rather like Britain, you know, well, yes. Oversexed, overpaid over here?
Yes, we met a lot of them because entertainment was organised for troops and officers, and people gave dances and asked them for tea or to stay or whatever. We made a point of asking British men, serving men, who happened to be in Australia to stay with us or come and visit us. As my mother had done that when she was in Singapore, because it gives the men a chance to get away from the military atmosphere, and come for meals and play badminton or card games and so on. And we did that in Australia. But through local people we got to know who gave dances and get-togethers for Americans. They had a pretty rough time in the fighting, and they really needed a rest and recreation.
Were they popular with Australians because of the way they were fighting the war?
Not particularly with the men, of course. but yes, I think a lot of Australian women married or were friendly with the Americans. One of the girls in our office was very friendly while living with an American colonel. And she had a lovely flat, nylon stockings, lipsticks, all sorts of things that we didn't have. But they were on the whole very pleasant, actually.
Were you picking up Japanese broadcasts, you know, in your information service?
Well, the upstairs, the ABC were, and they were passing them down to us. They had Japanese monitors there. They came into our office once or twice, and there was a very awkward feeling. But must have been awkward for them too.
Why was it awkward?
Well, nobody wanted to see a Japanese.
Oh, I see. They
needed them for translating. They were Japanese, presumably, who'd been living in Australia, and they could speak English as well as Japanese.
So they would have been the interpreters.
So using us, yes. Translators and interpreters. Yes. And they produced these reports which we got.
And they were treated with suspicion, were they?
Not suspicion, no. It was just a feeling of hostility, really.
Was there any internment in Australia of Germans, Italians, Japanese?
Very much so, yes. Actually, a family that we knew who lived near us, the mother and her sister were English, and the mother had married long before the First World War, a German from Freiburg, Paul Metz, whose family were well-known winemakers in that area. She'd had three sons, and they were actually fighting for the Germans. And after the First World War, she'd had twin daughters. Her husband had died very suddenly, just before the outbreak of war with Germany. And Mrs. Metz, her sister, and the two daughters had come out to Australia to see Mrs. Metz's brother, who was the Bishop of Queensland. But the daughters were German citizens, so they got interned in very harsh conditions. The camps were out in the outback, virtually in the desert, and they had very strict supervision. The girls were only about 19, 20, and they liked doing needlework and knitting. Even their knitting was subject to supervision, so that they weren't knitting a code into the garments that they were making. Anyway, through the offices of their uncle, the two girls were released, and they became nurses. They were allowed to do something like that, but they couldn't do anything that had any political overtones or join the forces or anything like that. But we knew them quite well.
Did you hear anything about the Dunera episode while you were in Australia? The ship of internees that came out, and there was news.
I remember the name, I can't remember the story of it now. No, when was that? Before the Japs came into the war?
Yes,
any Germans and Italians in Australia were, of course, had already been interned. Then, of course, when the Japs came into the war, they had a big camp of Japanese because there was a riot and a revolt. And someone wrote a book about it called Die Like the Cop.
Die Like the Cop?
Yes. I don't think I've still got the book. But it was about this. They made a film of it, too. The Japanese broke out and killed some of the Australian guards. I forget all the details of it now. Shook up the Australians a bit. But yes, the Australians were not very fond of Europeans anyway, I don't think, before the war. They had this inferiority complex. Everyone criticised them. They criticised us too, but we always reckon we got the best of all the arguments.